Hi, this is Kevin Halbert, and I'm on the phone with John Carlton. He's a good friend of mine and one of my father's best friends. Spent a lot of years marketing together, sharing advice and helping each other create masterful campaigns together. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well, Kevin. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I think this is kind of exciting that you went to your list and asked for some questions so we can kind of speed through some turbo hot seats here and just kind of answer people's questions. You know, your father and I were instrumental, along with Jay Abraham, in kind of creating the actual hot seats as they're used today. And of course, as most people know, a real hot seat can take a little time because we try to go really deep. But in the spirit of hot seats, we can go very, very quickly and answer questions with the idea of not just answering the questions, but really trying to deliver some actionable help that people can use so they can say, oh, okay, I'll do that. And that's why these things, even though we're zooming through a bunch of questions, can really be valuable. And a lot of times the questions you hear are questions that you hadn't thought of before. What was true with hot seats, and I say this every time I do a hot seat, is people are surprised to find that they get more value often from watching other people's hot seats or listening to questions being answered concerning other people's businesses, sometimes completely out of their market, sometimes completely out of, it just seems like it wouldn't be relevant, but it is. So watching the process, listening to how questions get answered, and even if you think it's not meant for you, it's not something that you can use, I will tell you that after, I don't know, I'm going on 30 years of doing this, that very much there will be things to pick up, and often major things to pick up, transformative things to pick up from listening to how questions and hot seats are done on other people. So that's why these kinds of calls are not just important for getting the actual questions answered, but for kind of broadening your mind, putting on your marketing thinking cap and thinking as you hear the questions, well, how would I answer that? And, oh, that's how Carlton answers it. It may be relevant to you. It may not. You may have a better answer yourself. But it's all about thinking critically. It's all about getting out of your isolated position, which most entrepreneurs are, where they're kind of staring at the screen and maybe they pick up the phone once in a while and they're really kind of on their own. And this is where we found over the years, and Gary and I discovered this early on, that sometimes the problems or the questions that become sticking points for marketers, and we're talking about holding you up sometimes for years where you can't move past it, sometimes those sticking points or those questions are easily answered. We used to solve what seemed like insolvable, horrible problems that had held people up sometimes for years, and we just solved them before the guy was through asking the question. And it wasn't that we were performing magic. It's that we just been around the block so many times. I've been, you know, in the front lines of business for 30 years. So I through my career, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of different things, to try a lot of different things, and because I've been a problem solver, I've come across nearly all of the problems in business. So it's not a magic act, and it's not that I'm some brilliant genius, you know, who was delivered here from outer space or something. It's merely a matter of me having experienced a lot of things and really put myself out there and done the balancing act without a net for a much longer time. So I am able to just, it's just the way my brain works. I'm able to look at things from kind of outside the box and figure out a way to solve it. I've been doing this for so long. So nobody should feel bad if the question gets answered very, very quickly. There aren't that many questions in marketing, Kevin. I'm not sure how many there are, but a lot of questions seem specific to your market, to your situation, to what's going on with you, and it seems very personal, and it seems very specific. However, almost all questions that people bring up in business have some correlation with something else that's happened in business, often in another market, often in another world. You know, there are answers that will come from the pre-web world that will make total sense to people who are only online. And I'm hoping that as we go through these questions that you got, that becomes really evident.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. The you know, the favorite part, my favorite part of being at those seminars and stuff was always the hot seats. The hot seats always seemed to be the most productive, that got everybody going. I think one of the best parts of the hot seats, you know, some of the questions come up often, but a lot of times it's people are just too close to the subject.
Yeah.
And they can't stand back. And there's a whole room of people standing back, and they can, you know, and someone else can even have a similar problem come up with a question, and it starts answering a bunch of problems for other people in the room.
That's what's good about being in a room full of people, even non-experts. I mean, you get the experts, and they'll give their kind of their opinion from how they've dealt with it, either as a consultant or in their own business or working, you know, with someone as a client. But often other people just have done that. I mean, I've seen that so many times. Somebody will say, "Oh yeah, I had that problem last year, and here's how I solved it." And, you know, it's like, this is great. This is better than what the experts have said. You know, during a teleseminar like this, it's just you and I on the phone, bringing our expertise and our experience to play here. But you know, let's just dive in so people start to get a feeling for this. You had a really good response to the email asking for questions, so that was this will be interesting.
Okay, I picked out a few here, and we'll see. We'll get through as many as we can.
Yeah.
Brandon sent in a question, and he says, "Hey guys, I want to keep this short and brief because I know you guys are both extremely busy. My question is, what is the best way to fail fast? What I mean by this is, when you're testing different markets to find out which one is hot and which one is not, what's the best way to do that? Because time is our most valuable resource, and there's no need in wasting it on a market that's dead."
You know, that's a big part of Operation Money Suck, is the idea that a lot of people, and we see this a lot, and a lot of marketers or even small business owners, one of the big mistakes that people will make is they think, I'm going to start a restaurant, and I'm going to pour my life savings into this restaurant, and I'm going to do all this stuff, and you think to yourself, how tough can it be to open a restaurant? There are restaurants all over the place, people got to eat. And you start getting into it, and that's an example of failing slow. As everybody knows, the average restaurant in America, I think the average life span of a restaurant is 3 to 6 months or something, and they go belly up. They're underfunded. They're in the wrong place. It's just things go bad right from the start. Now, even in marketing, the same thing can happen. What happens is that you get all caught up in the idea of, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to sell this product. This is how I'm going to create the product, and this is how I'm going to find people, and I'm going to sell it to them. Whereas most smart marketers kind of work almost in an opposite way. They find hot markets. They find out if there is a hot needs within that market that they can fill. So they can fix problems, or they can actually present something, a service, a product, advice, a continuity membership site, something that will serve the needs of that market, and then they start moving on. Well, how much are people? You know, how much is it worth to people? What is that term value? And no, but you can bring a lot of value to someone's life by answering questions or by solving some problems that they have. But then the next step is putting a price tag on that. Sometimes it's free, like in this call. You're getting free advice. That's great. Other times you want to get a consultation. That may cost you a lot. Other times it may be a full-on marketing assault where you're actually creating a campaign where it's going to take a long time to roll out. There's going to be a lot of elements involved and things like this. And there are certain things that I see a lot of marketers forget about, such as, one, do people really want this product or service? Two, are they willing to pay for it? And three, how much are they willing to pay for it? And things like that. So by failing fast, that's a tactic that smart marketers do whenever, even if they're doing something new within their own market that they know very, very well. They have a good list. They've sold stuff successfully. You still want to know right off the bat that if this thing is going to fail, if it doesn't have legs, if it's not going to resonate with the crowd you're after or dealing with, if there's something that's going to prevent this from being a profitable experience for you as a marketer, you want to find out as quickly as possible. So what that means is you try to get something out there right away. It could be as simple as to start out with a questionnaire, for example. Just find out if people are interested in this or not. I know a number of marketers who just routinely, before they do something, they'll send out an email to their, "Hey, would you guys want to know about blah?" And there's nothing coy or secretive about it. It's just I'm thinking of getting into this. And depending on the response they get, they will decide how hot the temperature is in their market for this. When you're going to other markets and you're going to try, let's say you're going to a market outside of your, you know, what you're experienced with, you want to do some research. You want to find out as much as you can about this so that you can at least make some kind of splash very inexpensively. And you want to find out very, very quickly before you invest time, money, energy, and a lot of details into a product or service that you're going to do, whether people are going to want it and whether they're going to pay for it. So, again, the mistake that a lot of people make is they gear up for a long-term campaign. They may even buy office space, hire secretaries to handle the phones, or get all this stuff going based on the idea, which is, and a lot of people think this way, plan for success. There's a difference between planning for success and working a program or a process or a sales funnel to be successful once you know that you're in the right place. I mean, you can plan for success digging a mine in a mountainside, but if you don't know there's gold in there, you can have one of the best-looking mines with all the best equipment and the best staffs and have everything going smoothly and never find what you're looking for because there was no gold in there in the first place. So failing fast means get there and don't lock yourself in. So you've got a fail-safe way to get out. In other words, you're not tied in with some long-term program. You're finding out as quickly as possible whether something that you've put together with minimal time and effort so that you are fulfilling on your promises and you've identified the needs of your market and you can get this stuff out. So that you want to find out whether somebody is going to pay anything for this. So you don't want to start out with a high price. You want to probably underprice it, over-deliver. Just see if it's the kind of bait that the market out there will bite on, so to speak, so that you're fishing in an area where there are, you know, there are people there with the needs and they're interested at some level. Otherwise, and again, I see this all the time, people just confuse that idea of planning for success, meaning that I'm going to make this successful no matter what. Well, those are the famous last words of a lot of people who went down in flames, just thinking backwards. The market has to want it, the market has to value it, and the market has to have shown some evidence of already spending money for it, and then you come in and you have to see that you are in a good groove where what you're delivering is going to be accepted and paid for. Does that make sense, Kevin?
Oh, it makes total sense. It makes total sense. that makes sense. I was just wondering, when you do that survey and stuff, is there a way to, you know that whole thing where people ask and they say, you know, they'll say this stuff, but whether you're not, then you bring it to them, they didn't prove it by buying it. It's just what they said, not what they do. Is there a way to filter that?
Some experience to that, Kevin. So you know, it's sometimes like the tricks of surveys. Surveys can trick you up a bit because sometimes people will say yes to something, but it's not what they say that counts. It's what they do in marketing. So you may get a whole bunch of people saying, "Heck yeah, I'd spend $100 for that if you had it," and then you actually put it together and you find out, no, they're not going to spend $100. They thought they would, but when it came right down to it, they didn't actually do it. So. So you have to keep that kind of stuff in mind. But again, make sure you've got your out. So by people saying yes, I'd be interested in that, and maybe you can even get more specific. I would spend a certain amount of money for that. I would and I would invest some of my time and energy in learning how to do this. So I think you should do that. You still want to make sure that you've actually had somebody pay for this, and then at any price at all, and then pay for it at a price where it's going to be profitable. And then you keep wanting to test it to make sure that people are going to pay for it on a consistent basis, not ask for refunds, that you're going to be okay fulfilling on these promises. And again, it could be everything from an ebook to a coaching program to just plain old consulting to providing a product that they buy. And it could be DVDs. It could be any number of things. This works offline, too, again. So if if you're opening a restaurant, for example, you want to find out if there are restaurants that have been in the area before, how have they done, what kind of restaurants are people in the area, most likely to go and patronize and a lot of different things. But don't go in blind. Don't thinking that you're going to throw money at it and make, or just by sheer force of will, you're going to make it work. That's a sure path to murdering your your potential profits all the way down the line. And I also, and it's very human for people to get involved in a situation where, because something's not working, a project they thought sure was going to work, they put a lot of time and energy into it and money, it's not working, they will abandon the stuff that is working in order to pour all their time and energy in the stuff that's not working because it pisses them off. And they keep thinking, just by sheer force of will, I can make this work. And it becomes this kind of challenge, and they get confused. And one of the biggest pieces of advice that I give out often when I'm consulting with people or doing hot seats is, you need to stop doing this and start doing more of this that's working. Stop doing what's not working. Start doing more of what's working.
Yeah, that's what my dad did with the Halberts thing. You know, they gave up the catalog, found out one or two things that sold, and just ran with it like crazy. And that's when they started really booming.
And that's a good example. I think most people know the story, but there was a catalog with a number of different items in it. And when they actually looked into it, they saw that only one or two items were carrying the entire load of what was a catalog. So you had to stop thinking like, we've got a catalog. Because if you think, my product is a catalog, then it's hard to break it down. So because nobody has a two-item catalog. A catalog has hundreds of items in it. You know, there's a lot of different stuff. So you have to stop thinking in limited terms. You have to think in more. You have to let the market tell you how to regard this, how to think about this. So that, you know, if they're only wanting to buy one or two things, then maybe you aren't a catalog after all. You are a marketer. You know, you are a service provider. You are whatever it is the market is telling you they need you to be able to continue patronizing you.
I agree 100%. All right, let's go to the next question. Michael.
What number is it? I'll
36.
Okay, 36.
You like 36?
Yeah, that looks pretty good.
Okay, so Michael's saying, what's the quickest way to learn the most you can about a target market that you're unfamiliar with when you've just been hired to write a sales letter to them?
Okay, this is standard freelance writing behavior, but it's good for even marketers that aren't writing for other people. And either they're in their own market or they're branching out into other niches within their market or even completely outside of their market. And the way you do this, it's just research. What you want to do, especially online, especially if this, let's talk about online markets, but the same holds true for offline markets too, which would be like brick and mortar stores, things like this. You want to put on your research hat, your detective hat, and you want to find out a number of things. There's kind of a loose checklist. Let me see if I can remember it. First, you want to find out what kind of competition is in this market. Now, if you can actually nail down the market, let's say it's knitting, you know, how to knit for fun and profit or whatever, or it's how to get better gas mileage out of your car, or it's how to start an online business, you know, wildly different things. You can actually go to the standard rates and data, the SRDS service, and you can find out what kind of lists are out there. So how big are the lists? And I use knitting because the last time I looked at knitting in standard rates and data, there were very few mailable or emailable lists for knitting back then. This is probably, it's four years ago. That may have changed, so this is just an example. This is a theoretical example. But even if you had a great product in knitting, there weren't a lot of people who had already raised their hands and said, I'd like to buy some stuff about knitting. Mm-hmm. And I'll buy it either through direct mail or online through some kind of direct response thing. So there weren't a lot of names. Now, you can also use Mr. Google and hop on and start asking the search, you know, start searching using terms that you think the average person might use within this market. So let's just stick with knitting just for the sake of having an example. Say, you know, I have arthritis. How can I continue to knit even though I'm having trouble with my fingers? Or I want to learn more about knitting from experts. Or I want to find people who knit in my community, things like that. So just start thinking wildly. Think out of the box. Think inside the box. Think as regular as you can. And very quickly you will start to find how Google treats these searches and where they're sending you. So you will start to identify the sites that are already up. You'll start to identify if there are forums out there, if there are online communities where they're talking to each other, things like that. You can find out a lot of stuff. Now, that's the first part. You want to find out how vibrant and how active the market actually is. Then you want to start to find out what is the potential competition that you're up against. Who else is out there marketing something for sale? So they are either hosting something, they're providing services, or they're selling products. So find out and start making lists of this stuff. Who and who is big. And you can tell who's big or getting the most hits by, you know, their ranking on Google. And once you start finding this out, you can find out if there are big players or if there's a number of small players or if it's a wide open and there's one big player and a whole bunch of little players, but the little players are doing okay, and all of these types of things. And then you want to actually opt in as much as you can. Find out how they're dealing with people. So this is called drafting the people who have already made this work. Don't go out there and try to reinvent the wheel. Find out what other people are doing. They have already, especially if you find a successful marketer who's already spent some time in there, the way they phrase things, the questions they ask, the way they talk to their audience is going to give you huge insight into how you can talk to the audience for the very first time since you haven't been in this market before. So there's a lot of advantages to that, to just doing some basic research. You can do this in an afternoon, or if you have the time, you can do it during over the course of a week or even longer. The more research you do, and especially when you sign up on other people's sites and see how they respond when you do sign up, it'll give you all kinds of ideas of what you can write to make your client successful. Now, you can also help your client, if he hasn't done the research he needs to do in this market, to help position himself in this market, because if he's not alone in this market, and I don't think, Kevin, there are any markets left online, you would be the only marketer, but you know, you may be one of a handful, or you may be one of a mob of other marketers, but you're going to have to position yourself, or you're going to have to help your client position himself as either the high price guy, the low price guy, the guy who has more expert information, or the guy who is just a regular guy who's done more research than everyone else or whatever. But how are you going to position yourself? And you can't begin to answer that until you have the questions. How much are people charging at the high end? How much are they charging at the low end? Who's being more successful, the low end or the high end guys? What are they doing for a back end? How are they making their profit? How are they dealing with people? What kind of continuity series and stuff? So you get this information. Yeah. Again, you can do it very quickly, or you can spend more time on it. But if you've got to get yourself a toehold in this so that you become if not an expert, you become very knowledgeable about this market just from spending some time looking into it. Does that make sense, Kevin?
No, that makes sense. And I mean, I guess if you could also possibly look at their meta tags and how much they're buying keywords for and stuff like that, and and just that traffic to those keywords and stuff.
Well, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's a couple of different ways to go. Is your client going to be doing a pay-per-click campaign where they're going to be actively searching for people who are looking for what you have? Are they going to try to do organic search engine ranking, or are they going to just get online and see what happens and actually start doing affiliate marketing, start setting up ways so that other marketers, either say through ClickBank or people within the market, are going to do joint ventures with a number of different ways to position yourself and to make it to make that money funnel work. So you're either going after people who are raising their hands and saying, I want more info on this, or I'm looking for this stuff, or you can start working with other people who already have the list, or you can do a number of different things. So getting all this straight in your head and seeing what's going on. If you're a freelancer, part of the things that freelancers bring to the table is knowing these questions. A lot of people think, I'm just going to do a pay-per-click thing. I'm going to get in this market, so would you write me a piece that will help me with this and write me all the AdWords and stuff? And you may come back and say, you can do this, but you're going to be in a very crowded market, and it's going to be very expensive, because what you thought was going to be a cheap word or search phrase or search term is going to be very, very expensive, and you're going to be up against a lot of other people and blah, blah, blah. So have you looked into Facebook ads? Have you looked into advertising on other people's sites? Have you looked into buying banners? Have you looked into joint ventures with people? Have you blah, 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 and do all this, have you looked into affiliate marketing, things like this? And, as an experienced freelancer, you bring all this to the table. You can help the client more than just give them a good letter. And, of course, as Gary always said, a good letter to the wrong audience isn't going to do anything. It's a rock that leaves a very little ripple in the lake when it disappears. So.
Gotcha. Okay, so I'm looking at the next questions for...
What number?
35 and 34, you pick.
No, just grab one.
All right.
This one's directly for me, number 34.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Michael asks a question for John Carlton. Is there a limit to how many times you can directly sell to your prospects?
That's an interesting question, and that leads me to believe when during a real live hot seat where I'd be facing Michael, and, you know, my question, or excuse me, my next statement would not be to answer that question or even attempt to answer. I would back up and say, why are you asking that? Because what this leads me to believe is that he has either gotten some bad information from somebody, or he's gotten confusing information from somebody, or he is interpreting results that he's getting in a odd way. And when I say odd, that doesn't mean he's doing anything wrong. What he's doing is typical of entrepreneurs who are isolated, who don't have a good network, who don't mastermind with other people, who don't get out and go to seminars and meet people and network and trade names and talk to people. So that when you're alone, you start to think in ways that are a little off, just meaning that you need to stop thinking that way and start thinking in more real terms. So there's nothing wrong with this. There's no such thing as a bad question unless you keep asking it over and over again once you've gotten the right answer. So is there a limit to how many times you can directly sell to your prospects? Of course not. What Jay Abraham, of course, talked about many, many years ago was the lifetime value of a customer. And a lot of people didn't understand this. A lot of even top marketers, and they do it today, would make a single sale to somebody and never have a back end. One of the first things I do as a consultant is make sure the person has a back end, the client that I'm talking to, because often the first sale is not where you're going to make your most money. But you're going to make your most money after you've established the trust, bonded a bit, delivered on the first product. A lot of people take a loss on that first product because they know that once somebody comes into their world, gets on their list, they're going to buy a lot.
Yeah.
And the reason they buy a lot is because you keep producing value. You actually become a go-to person. You become a resource for them in a lot of different ways. So there is no limit. Often the people that buy the most from you are going to be your best customers for the life of your business. They're going to, they may not buy everything, but the things that they'll buy, they'll think about and they'll buy, and they buy because they trust you. They know that you are a resource that has proven yourself, so that they're not taking a risk, and it's, you know, they're interested. And the more interested they are, you know, let's say they buy your first product, they apply it, they got some results, and they said, this is a guy I want to look at. What, you know, I often get emails, people saying, what else do you have? I've already bought everything you've had. I need more stuff. Everything I've gotten from you, I've tried, and it's worked, and this is like a gold mine for me to be able to do this. So our problem is producing enough so that, you know, I know that Gary had the same problem. It's just, so sometimes it's just, you wind up selling consultations, or you wind up, you know, selling events or something like this, just to be able to satisfy the people who realize what a valuable resource that you represent and what, you know, what good you can bring to their business. So it's a very straightforward answer. There's no limit to how many times you can sell directly to a prospect.
Right.
However, within that doesn't mean that you need to even think about that. As you're going, the numbers talk. This is always a numbers game. So during this, I mean, I have a fairly hot list. We still do affiliate sales to our list, so we will sell other people's products. We will give people an opportunity to look at other people's events and other people's we don't pretend we're in some kind of isolated little universe where we're the only marketers that our prospect is paying attention to. We know there's other things going on out there, and we want to be a resource. We want to be a total resource. So if somebody else has a better answer for them than we do, we will tell them that. We will send them there that way. So, but you're still making sales. This is a capitalistic endeavor. So you're still thinking about, what's the ways that I can maximize income while providing maximum value, or over-delivering on maximum value, so that you continue to be a trusted resource that you have a relationship with. So it's kind of like saying, how many times can you kiss your wife once you're married? You know, it's unlimited. It's kind of up to you and the other person. So
yeah, as long as you start that great relationship. And talking about, you know, the lifetime value of a client, you know, those people that don't focus on that, you know, the other person who does understand the lifetime value of a client can eat you alive, because they can outspend you, they can out, you know, market you, they can, you know, they understand that they can take that loss on the front end, where the other guy's just trying to make it on the first run.
That's a good point, Kevin. And even all the way down the line, they can one of the things that happens online, anyone who's been marketing online for even a couple of years knows that what is now being given away free as bonus material, was just a couple of years ago being sold for a lot of money. And what happened was that somebody out there, some marketer, just said, you know, okay, this has been sold, like, say, how to build your list. There were a lot of products out there, how to build your list fast with great quality leads. That used to be a product that people would sell. And then suddenly people started saying, well, you know, I'll give it to you for free because what I've got to sell, you know, it starts with having a great list, you know, with having a lot of traffic. And then we move on from there. So even though they're in information marketing, they want you to already have the traffic and stuff going so they can go to the next level, so to speak. So what they want to do is give that stuff away for free. You still there, Kevin? I'm getting a weird noise here.
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay.
There's a little static, but I don't know. Still got you.
Sounds like a storm blowing through. So anyway, you shouldn't saddle yourself with being a one-trick pony where you think, I'm going to sell a product on how to get traffic, and I'm going to hang my hat on that for the rest of my life. Well, markets change all the time, and what was once worth money is now given away for free. So you've got to be thinking about this as you're going along. So what you bring as value to your customers will be an evolving thing as you go along, and your best position is to be that guy who is able to evolve, who is able to stay on the forefront of the market, who knows what's going on, and provides value beyond what you can actually create inside of a product. It's also what you're able to share, what you know, the people you bring to the table, the opportunities for networking and finding out other things.
Yeah.
One of the best things you can do as a marketer is just be that one stop. Just, you know, where your prospect says, you know, I want to see what Kevin has to say. You know, but, you know, I wonder what Kevin's been up to, you know, the last couple of days since I checked. And he goes, and that rewards him. He finds out, wow, this is great. I didn't realize this was going on. Oh, I was wondering about that, and now Kevin's into it, things like that.
Gotcha. Good answer. Okay, so I think
now we're going to Billy.
We're going to do 35, and then I want to get you into number 27.
Okay.
So number 35 is Billy. Gentlemen, the pricing of a product, does it really make a difference if it's $19.95 or a round figure of $20? Most everything seems to be priced ending in $95, $97, or $99. Perhaps on my next project I'll test a round figure of $20, but maybe that would be a waste of money. Have you ever done a split run of price figures?
Actually, that's a great question because it's one of the common things that people complain about marketing. I mean, it's a punchline in a lot of you know comics talk about it. You know, it's 1995. You know, why is it 19? You know, or 1999? Why is it one more penny to $20? Just tell me it's $20. But the truth is, what we're dealing with here is a sales process. Billy starts with it sells on facts, or sells on reason, I guess is the way to do it. Excuse me, it pitches on reason. It actually sells on emotion. And what that means is that when you actually make the decision to buy, your brain shifts a little bit, and you get out of that rational thing. So you set yourself up with the help of the person doing the selling by sending up this rational reasons, this rational menu of reasons why this is a good buy, why it's a bargain, why you agree with them. Yeah, you're the guy I should deal with. I do want this product. I do believe it's going to help me. I believe it's going to help me now. And, you know, I need to buy it now. So, and then your mind kind of shifts and you pull out your credit card or you pull out your cash or whatever and you pay. That, you know, study after study has shown that there is a difference between $20 and $19.95. It doesn't rationally seem to make sense because if you sit down and think about it, it's only a penny, but $20 enters an emotional area in your head where it's like, oh, geez, I'd spend 19, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, but $20, I'm, you know, I got a cutoff. Everybody has cutoffs. Psychologically, for whatever reason, those round numbers are cutoffs. So $99 is not $100. So,
well, it's also an extra digit in there.
Yes, but oh yeah, that's part of it too, but not from 19 to 20.
Right.
But the idea that everybody has a cutoff of what something's worth, and as a salesman, you are presenting an argument to make it worthwhile to them to decide that this is something they should buy now, and they can fit it in their life, and it makes sense, and it's a bargain. At some level, it's a bargain, maybe a high price bargain, because you know you make the case that hey, normally this will cost you thousands and thousands of dollars. There's no other way for you to get this. I, however, have a way for you to get this for $1,000, or excuse me, under $1,000,
right.
It's $900 or it's $999. but it's under $1,000. So the way it gets positioned in the prospect's head is, okay, normally I'd have to spend several thousand dollars. This is under $1,000. So that kind of thinking, it's shorthand for ways to position it. Because if it's an even $1,000, then, you know, is it, you know, it's, you can't say it's under $1,000. It is $1,000. And does that make a difference? It does. Kind of a lot of people have that idea that I'm going to do something until this level and I'm not going to go beyond that. It's kind of like the difference between, you know, running times in track. I mean, you're talking about a split second. What difference does a split second make? Right. Well, in Olympic in Olympic running, they're going to a thousandth of a percent of a second. Yeah. So it's 6 seconds, you know, six dot, and then three figures after that to determine it, because it's sliced so finely. So numbers do matter.
Yeah.
And the other thing he said, though, is really the good answer, is go ahead and test it. I will tell you that probably, Billy, that you are going to find that you're going to take some kind of hit if you round off to $20. You may not. Depends on your market. You may have a market where if $20 doesn't mean very much to them, say you're going to a really wealthy market, then it's like, they're always talking about that. You know, $20 is like what $5 used to be to them. It's just something they whip out and do without thinking. Then maybe that's going to work. Maybe you'll find something out. But I will tell you that most of the people that have tested, they test very finely, and their idea of testing is to test $39 versus $49. And you could actually make the point in a lot of markets. Well, what's the difference between $10? Well, it can mean the difference between a large number of sales. So you will sell more at a lower price sometimes. However, I will tell you that the last test I saw for 39 versus 49 was Dean Jackson was testing it in a market. He was actually testing it at the same time I was writing about it in my newsletter. And we were laughing because he found that 49 sold exactly the same number of units that 39 did. There was no psychological difference in the mind of the buyer between 39 and 49 in that market. Now, other markets may find it different, but if he hadn't tested, he would have stayed at 39 for a long time, essentially leaving $10 on the table for every sale he made. So this was an important test that he made, and he didn't go to 50, and he never tested 40, because most marketers who have been in the game for a while understand that that's not a, you know, there's a lot of things to test. That's not something we need to test. Because it's only, you know, saying $20 instead of $19.95 is nothing to me. You know, it's the same number of keystrokes. It doesn't help my argument. It doesn't give me anything else to talk about. So why even test $20 as opposed to $19.95 when so many people have been out there doing this before? And if you get a lot of negative feedback from your market saying, why do you do that? Why don't you just call it $20? Well, fine. Then maybe then, you know, because there's an uproar in the market, maybe then you would consider doing it. I will tell you that you will not get that uproar. People do not think, oh, it's $19.99. Why doesn't he just say $20? Maybe that thought briefly goes through their head. But you know what? If you're doing this right, they're not thinking about this at all. They're thinking, oh, it's $19.99. Okay, that's about $20. I'll buy this. I'm in. Blah, blah, blah. And they're moving on. So it's not something to spend a lot of time on.
Well, I agree. And, the big dogs have tested the hell out of this. And, you know, there's a reason that they're doing the numbers, just like you said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the interesting thing I would be curious to learn about myself would be, on like a shipped product, if you just said $20 as a round number, price, tax, shipping, everything included, that would just make their mind, you know, instead of them going, oh, okay, what are they going to add on to this?
That's good. I like that, if you can do that. Of course, again, it's a numbers game. You know, don't shoot yourself in the foot, especially with a worldwide market where shipping can be quite a bit to ship over to Shanghai.
So
be careful of how you do it, how you position it. Pricing is a whole subcategory of marketing. You can have a great product priced wrong and it won't sell. You can have a product priced too low and you'll sell, but you'll wind up leaving money on the table. Or the difference could be a couple of bucks, could be $100, could be $1,000. I'm going through the same gyrations with somebody who wants to sell something, and they're asking me, you know, they haven't sold it yet. Now they have sold versions of this product they have, and it's a coaching program, at various prices, but nothing that gives them good insight into how to take it outside of their core market and sell it elsewhere. And the answer is, you're just going to have to test. You cannot figure this out by just going back and forth in intellectual arguments. You are going to have to test at some point. Now, in the bad old days before the web, that testing could take a long time. It could be very expensive. You'd mail a campaign at a certain price, or you'd do A-B split tests on the mailing, or you'd try to, you know, go into a magazine with one price one time and then go into another magazine, you know, with another price, and get all that data and stuff and look at it. It could take months to kind of figure that out. Now, online, you can find this out in an afternoon, because if you got any kind of traffic at all, you can do A-B split testing, A-B-C split testing. You can do all kinds of things, test stuff around and start to get it. And once you get a significant number of responses, and that's called a statistically significant number, in mailing, that would be 2,000 to 5,000 pieces.
Right.
As far as online traffic, I think most people want to get 5,000 responses, 5,000 opt-ins. Or if you're waiting to see what number of people are buying, you have to measure that against what you've done before, or just get a good feeling for it. Sometimes the information you get, by the way, in testing isn't statistically significant. In other words, it wouldn't pass scientific muster with a statistician. But it helps your gut. I mean, if you got zero buying at one price and 10 buying at another, then that's something. I mean, that's something you can't. You're still going to keep an eye on it, but you got some. If you sell 10 at one price and 9 at another, that's not an answer. You're saying, wow, well, it's still up there. Well, let's continue looking at this, you know, and let's pay attention to this. And you know, even 99 and 100 or 89 versus 100, good results are ones where you can just say, oh, that was quick. Okay, let's do this and not this. Often that's not what it is. It's a little murky. You have to kind of apply your gut-level feeling to it, and you're going to want to revisit it, because it may be something happened that made one price work today that isn't going to make it work tomorrow or next week or next year, something like that.
Yeah, and the other thing I think about pricing is like, let's say, I think it depends on if you have a back end or not. If you don't have a back end and you double the price, but you still get 75% of the sales,
right?
Your gross income's better, but you lost all those names to either rent as lists or follow up with.
That's a really good point. That's why it's all a numbers game. And I was just telling somebody this morning. What do you want? Do you want a big list? Do you want a big list of buyers that you can then go to and sell other stuff to? Or do you want to make as much money as you can on a high-price thing and have a small number of people who have bought a high-price thing? If you're doing consulting, for example, high-end consulting that costs a lot of money, then you don't want a large list of people who have bought something cheap. You want a small list,
right,
or as big a list, who have risen, it's like players with money. You want people who have demonstrated they're willing to spend a lot of money for the value, and when the value is clearly explained to them, and you're able to fulfill on that.
Yeah.
So you have to keep thinking this all the time. And I know marketers of every single example that you can think of, every single different way of looking at that. They have two lists. They have a core list of high, people who spent a lot of money. They have a broader list of people who have maybe made one sale or two sales, or one buy or two buys, and the amount of money they've spent, and they're able to look at this and realize that their market is not a single, a single kind of customer. It's a varied type of customer. There's the guy with a lot of money who bought this and would like to buy more and is actually able to buy it at a higher price. There are a larger number of people who maybe didn't buy the higher priced one but would buy a lower priced one and are waiting for this and things like this. So that's how you start to find that out. You can't guess it beforehand. You need experience. You need to be looking at this critically, and you need to be testing as you go.
Yeah. Good answer. Good answer. All right, 27. The reason I'm asking about 27 is I just want to see if you have the same thoughts as I do about this question. And this guy, Donnie's writing, I have a client that has been less than forthcoming with information that I feel I need to, that I need to make the most compelling copy possible. He says he has insider knowledge in a particular industry, which I don't doubt that he really possesses, but he can't reveal or describe his deep cover, can't describe his deep cover sources or describe his own background experience. Online, he appears to be a newcomer to his niche, zero Google trail. The information he provides is great, but you don't get the really valuable stuff until you buy his product. So here's the question. How can I write powerful copy while dealing in generalities? He continues, the whole I have top secret connections hook can be a tough one to swallow. I already know the best answer for this question. I should have a better qualified, I should have better qualified the client so I knew all of this before we got started. I need the second best solution to my situation.
Gotcha. And that's something you're gonna encounter as a freelancer or as a consultant or in a lot of businesses where you're dealing with people. I can see an accountant having a similar type of problem. I can see a lawyer, you know, somebody wants to sue somebody and they're not forthcoming. So, yes, Donnie has the right answer. It's not shame on you for not vetting this guy more, but as a client, you're going to have different levels of clients. So this may be a client where you actually step back and you do not provide full service. You do not consult with them. You do not try to do any research for him. You do not try to help him do this. Rather, you become about the most baseline type of writer possible, which is you ask him to tell you, what do you want me to say so that you sound coherent, and you are essentially a ghostwriter. What is the story that you want me to write? You tell me the story, and I will write it. And then actually you can get record a call with the guy and just say, you know, what is it that you want somebody to know about you? And why do you think this makes you worthwhile to buy? And they will tell you this, and you provide the story in a well-written manner, in a way that he can then pop up online or put into a sales letter or whatever vehicle he's going to use, and then you wash your hands of it. Now, the other thing is that when you do this again, Donnie, make sure that there's a product there. Make sure that there's a book. If this guy has inside stuff and I don't know what the product is. If it's not a book, if it's personal consultation with this guy, then just, he's either able to go through a mock consultation with you, or you should be able to listen in on a conversation, or, you don't want to do anything illegal and have him illegally record something, but, ask a client, would you mind if this guy sits in on this? He's actually, writing a book and blah, blah, blah. We're not going to reveal anything proprietary of yours. He just wants to hear this, and then sometimes you can do that. My suspicion is that this guy, I've encountered this many, many times in my career, and when you come across a client who thinks that they have something that they can't let out because it's so critical and they're afraid of being ripped off and it's going to be stolen and they're all thinking, I got the keys to the kingdom, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's largely a sign that you're dealing with a nutball, because this person... he's eventually going to have to lose control of insider knowledge that he has. If indeed he has it, and often you will find that what he thinks is really important isn't really important at all, and people aren't willing to spend money on. So I have encountered this before. I will tell you, it's a red flag that the guy may have some inside information. The guy may know things, but especially in this song, we're in the information age. If it's information that he has, then A, he's probably not the only guy that has it. If he is, that would be unique in the history of business. Two, if he's one of a handful that have it, then probably the other guys are already sharing it, or once they see that he is starting to share it, they're going to start to share it. So he's got instant built-in competition. And C, the more likely thing is that as soon as this gets out, it's going to spread like wildfire. If it's actually good, let's say he has a secret way to, pick stocks or something.
Right.
It's going to be all over the joint as soon as he does it. So keeping it secret from the copywriter who's trying to sell it is idiotic, because his only shot in many of the scenarios that I can think Donnie's client is in means that he's going to have to make a big immediate splash, more or less a launch.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's unlikely that he'll be able to sell it again, because once the cat's out of the bag, it's game over. He'll have to have something else bringing to the table. He might wind up just being a high-priced consultant who is a primary source of this information rather than the other consultants that spring up who are secondary sources of this information. So, when one of the good things you learn when you're a freelancer that you can bring to all kinds of marketing situations is this looking for red flags, looking for certain things. I will tell freelancers out there that when you encounter a client who says money is no object, when you start talking about the budget, he says, oh, money's no object. I'm going to pay for what it's worth. I will guarantee you that money is very much an object, and you are going to have trouble getting paid. You're going to have trouble nailing them down to actually sticking within a budget. There's going to be all kinds of money problems. And that seems counterintuitive until you've actually been in the business and you realize that the only guys who talk about money that way are the ones for whom money is a huge problem. A psychological problem, could be a physical problem. They don't have the money. or they're thinking they're going to bring up some deal they're going to negotiate later, but they don't want to negotiate now. They want to be in control of the negotiation. All kinds of things will come up. And that doesn't mean you should turn your back and run. You can deal with these people, but just be aware of that. Never take anyone's flat statements, especially unsolicited flat statements, such as, yeah, I've got a huge staff here that will help you. And if you didn't ask them if they had a big staff and they just said that, you know, you can, most of the time, you can take the opposite of what they say and know that that's probably closer to the truth than what they told you. And this is just the you know, just as part of being human. You know, a lot of people, they're trying to impress you to take on the job as much as you're trying to impress them so that you get the job. And they're going to say and do a lot of things. As writers, I urge writers to not try to present themselves as something that they're not. In my freelancing course that I wrote a long time ago, I had, you know, I had, you're in various stages. You're in a shameless horror stage where you're taking any job that comes along. Then you're in a stage where you're taking on jobs, but you're not presenting yourself as something you're not. You can even tell the guy, you know what, you're going to get me for cheaper than you would another writer, because this is the first time I've written in this market. However, I have written for other stuff, and here's some samples of what I've done. So, you know, you're going to give me this for this job, I will take it for a little less. However, you know, the next job that if we do together, you know, it'll be more volatile. You can position yourself, and don't position yourself as a hardcore, well-experienced veteran until you are. It will save you a lot of trouble. It will eliminate a lot of problems that people have when they try to talk the talk first before they can walk the walk. But here's the good side: is you will not be punished mostly if you're a rookie. People understand there are rookie writers out there, and the rookies may not bring everything to the table that they do, but they're within the price range. They're within the budget that the client wants. So there's a role for rookies out there. There always has been. There always will be. So don't. There's no need. There's no good that can come from trying to pretend you're something you're not. And there's a lot of good that can come from just being honest, just being straightforward. You don't need to deprecate yourself, but you need to be honest. Say, yeah, I would even tell somebody, you know what, I've never written for this market, although I've written for almost every market I've ever heard of. But, you know, I would say, I've never written for this market. So good chance that, you know, I'm going to have to do some research, see what's going on. I'm not sure I'll hit it the first time out. But, you know, if you're willing to take a shot, then I am too, and let's go. So.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I don't see how anybody who wants to make a buck is going to hire a copywriter is going to hamstring him by leaving him, you know, in the dark with what he needs to do.
Right.
But the thoughts I had on it were, if he has to go forward and move on, forward on it, is to write a blind copy ad like Lazy Man's Way or Seven Steps.
Well, that's kind of hard to do because, you know, all blind bullets and blind copy lead somewhere. So, you know, the only way you could do that would be if the guy understood blind copy and said, okay, I have three ways that will help you immediately to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And he would know what those were. So as a writer, you say, well, okay, I'm going to write a bullet that says pretty much that. Although if that guy is that savvy, he doesn't need a writer because he's already thinking in writerly terms.
Yeah.
So if he says, I've got ways that you don't know about, no one knows about, to do X, Y, and Z. And then you say, well, you know, you could spend the time and go, well, how many ways do you have? And the guy say, well, what do you mean, how many? Well, do you have six ways, a dozen ways, a thousand ways? He says, no, I've got, well, let me think, I got like a dozen ways. Okay. A dozen ways to do X, Y, Z. Would you agree with that? Yeah, that sounds right. Okay, then you write that. But I don't know why you'd want to go through those kind of gyrations because you're...
Well, it's just that's the only way, you know, those guys, they were selling something and they didn't even... The prospect didn't even know what the product really was.
Yeah.
It was kind of selling the story and selling the result. And you had to buy to figure out what was in between that.
Right. And that's a fair marketing tactic. Excuse me, to, you know, when you want to bring the prospect further into your world before you reveal the details, because the details may scare them. I'm in that position myself because I do a lot of coaching, and we do, you know, that dreaded W word, work, is actually involved in everything I do. That means,
right.
You know, people get scared of that. And if I just said, hey, come with me, work really hard, and I'll help you become, you know, successful, you're going to lose a lot of people right off the bat. So that is more or less what I say, but I find ways to say it so that they're not scared by that right away. So when some people hear me say, well, if you're willing to work a little hard, come with me, and I'll make you, you know, enormously successful, they hear in their minds, come with me and die slowly in a mine, you know, with no sunlight and starving to death. And they just, they awfulize everything. So you have to, as a writer, you have to position it in a way that it makes sense. Once people get into the, you know, quote, work, unquote, that I talk about, it is really simple, it's easy, and once you have that transformative breakthrough, it just, you know, it flows really smoothly. It's not that tough, but it's not a magic pill. And a lot of people are looking for magic pills where they say, you know, I don't want to actually have to learn to write. I want to punch a button on a piece of software and the thing's automatically written and everything is fine and people flock to me and buy my stuff. Well, good luck on that. Yeah. But, you know, there are people out there that will sell you that magic button.
And, well, they'll tell you that, too.
And they'll tell you that it's a magic button, so good luck on that. Yeah. So, you know, if when and I tell people, when you grow up and you realize that, okay, you are going to have to put a little elbow grease in there, come back, we'll teach you how to do these skills, and once you learn them, it's fast, simple, easy, and you are off to the races after that. And that's why we are successful with people who are finally serious about getting their game on.
Yeah.
I think we can take a couple more questions.
Okay. What do you think about number 17?
Well, if you like it, just read it out. That's
all right. Well, there's three. There's a three-parter, so.
By Mac?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was recently listening to a podcast radio show on marketing, and I heard one of the panel members say that Company X was too big for direct response marketing. Do you agree with this statement?
Well, let's just take these one at a time.
Sure.
He was listening to a podcast radio show on marketing. Well, first, I'd like to know what that podcast was. I don't know who's saying this.
Yeah.
But one of the panelists say Company X was too big for direct response marketing. Bullshit. you know, one of the big jokes that your dad and I used to have was, you know, what if Ford or General Motors or some of the bigger companies had come to us with some kind, you know, and let us do something other than what they call image advertising. A lot of marketers get confused because they think they know advertising because they've seen so many ads in their life. But the ads they've seen have been on television. You know, there was not a single good ad in yesterday's Super Bowl. Not
I noticed
a single one. They were all image, brand ads. They thought that, you know, let's get people really curious and let's make them laugh and they'll go. And they just violate every single rule. So people that go into marketing thinking that they're going to copy the ads that they see and hear and read out there and they're going to figure it out, you're being silly, because there are simple ways to do it, but those ways don't come naturally. A lot of them are counterintuitive. A lot of them involve actually applying a little bit of elbow grease and some skill to this, and mostly it's salesmanship. Most ads out there ignore salesmanship. Now, when you're talking about a company that's too big for direct response marketing, that's silly, because some of the bigger ones actually do direct response.
Yeah.
You know, the...
insurance.
Well, yeah, but I was thinking of Jack in the Box. You know, of all the food commercials, most of them do funny and then come eat my burgers because we're funny. Jack in the Box, if you watch them, they have changed my mind on being funny a little bit. David Ogilvy, the famous copywriter and owner of Ogilvy and Mather for years, used to say people don't buy from clowns, and he avoided humor like the plague in his writing. However, we've softened a little bit like this, and sometimes you can do it. And if you watch the Jack in the Box commercials, there are always elements of direct response in there, in that they give you an action to take. They will say, for this week only, such and such a sandwich is blah, is on sale, or we're bringing it back, and they pull it back off, and they do things like that. So those guys are kind of savvy in that they do that. Now, they don't spend a lot of time on it, because the other way to do that is the infomercial. You can imagine an infomercial for a hamburger joint. It'd just be all about the quality of the beef and all about all the reasons they think that their stuff is good. And, you know, that would, you know, that may or may not work. And based on the fact that there are so many food channels out there now, I think there are ways to make that work. The food channels, you know, on cable TV are just long infomercials for either restaurants or for products or for coaching or all kinds of things. So there are ways to institute direct response marketing in everything anybody does. You know, we talk about direct response marketing. If you're married out there, you sold yourself with direct response marketing to have her agree to marry you and actually go through with it. So all of us have an inner salesman. Most of the times that inner salesman is asleep or passed out, and often he never wakes up during your entire life. But if you can wake him up and you can actually start paying attention and start doing this stuff, everything you do can involve some kind of direct response marketing. All direct response marketing is you ask for an action. You say, you know what, why don't you do this, and this will happen. And it's part of the thing that's going on in the prospect's mind, which you want him to finally say at some point, wow, that is a pretty good product, and you know what, I agree with you. I think that's a product that I need right now, and I want it, and I think you're the guy I want to deal with, and yes, let's do this right now. I'll buy this right now. So all four of those elements, agreeing that it's a good product, agreeing that he wants it now, agreeing that you're the guy he wants to deal with, and agreeing that he's going to say, let's get this done right now. Let's do this now. So the difference between wanting it now and actually paying for it are two different things. Once you get that answer, that's the essence of direct response marketing, and it applies to all parts of life, buying product, making choices, getting married, buying a car, doing all kinds of things. So the answer to that is that I would wonder what the panel member was talking about, and I imagine he's talking about image advertising. And, you know, anybody who looks at image advertising thinks, well, I'm going to do what Coca-Cola does. Well, I would say fine. If you have 100 years and $1 billion at your disposal, then fine. Go ahead and do that kind of advertising. If you don't, then you better get down to the more to the stuff that actually works, which is what all the top marketers are doing in the mid to small size businesses and what the smart big ones are doing. Now, remember that part of what Coke, just to go off on that, Coke does image advertising, but you know where most of their sales happen is they got good shelf space at the store.
Yeah.
You walk into a 7-Eleven, at eye space on the store, you turn around, you look there's Coca-Cola, or it's Pepsi, depending on who bribed them the most. But it's not RC Cola. It's not the off-brand stuff. Those guys are struggling for shelf space way below them, sometimes behind them. There's all kinds of things going on. So there is a direct response element to this that has to do with where the point of purchase is happening, and it goes on and on. We can get off that. Let's go to the second one. Okay. The answer is no. That's a silly answer, and I can't even imagine how I would pretend to try to justify that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, would you say you got one more question left, maybe?
Oh, no. If you want to finish these or you want to jump to another one, just
okay.
Take a few more minutes.
All right. Let me go back then. Where was I? What number was on? Do you remember?
It was 17.
17. All right. Second question is, I have noticed that some organizations and companies try to embed the banner in the website to make it look like part of the website rather than, say, an advertisement. Wouldn't it be better to make it stand out? If it looks like part of the website, doesn't that run the risk of reducing the click-through rate? I reckon people might not click on it because they might think it isn't a link to be clicked on. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a good example of what we were talking about earlier, of trying to overthink something that can be tested in an hour.
Yeah.
So try it both ways and prove it to yourself. Or get out there and actually you can Google that kind of stuff. You know, should banners look like ads or should they look like part of the thing? You know, the classic way of doing print ads, when your dad and I were doing, or your dad even before he met me, was doing full-page ads in a magazine or a newspaper, you tried to make it look as much as like the editorial part of the newspaper. In other words, you made it look like in a newspaper, an actual page in the newspaper with a story, as close as you could get it to that, using the same typeface, using the same design styles, using the same way, so that it looked seamless. That was a great way to get it read, because people would just think, oh, there's a story. Oh, my God, there's a story about how to blah, whatever.
Right.
And, of course, magazines and newspapers rebelled against that when they realized they were essentially, you know, that seemed like unfair to them. So they start saying, you can't do that. You got to put an advertising slug up top.
Yeah.
Or you can't use our typeface or things. And, you know, it'd be a constant battle going back and forth. But that was part of the more seamless you could make it as part of the newspaper, the higher your readership would be. The other side of that is often you could still do the same thing, even being blatantly different. Excuse me, but in still using long copy, so you could it might not look like a page ripped out of that newspaper, but it'll look like a page of editorial copy from some newspaper. So even though it's different, even though it said had big slug up top said advertising. In fact, you know, you could even warn them that, you know, this is an ad. You know, don't think it's part of our publication. And we found overall that won't hurt readership. That what's going to happen is the people aren't reading the slugs. Or if they read the slugs, they are more interested in a good headline that brings them into it, wakes them up. And, you know, you want your ad to be the most exciting thing he's read today. So regardless of how it gets in front of them, you know, he may say, oh, this is an ad. I am absolutely disgusted that somebody's tried to put an ad. Oh, my God, what is this? What? I need to find this out. Then he's off on that grease slide where if you're telling the story correctly and you're addressing problems that he has, this guy's questions, you know, kind of make me think like he hates advertising himself, doesn't and thinks salesmanship is somehow evil in and of itself. And you just got to grow up. Get past that. The world runs on salesmanship. If you have a product that I need or that I could use to solve a problem that I have, then shame on you if you don't use everything in your capacity, every tool available to you, to make me realize that what you have is going to solve my problem, and you're the guy I should be dealing with, and I should buy it now.
Yeah.
You are doing me a favor. Advertising lets people know that there's stuff out there. If you're selling a worthless product, if you're selling an unethical product, then I hope you rot in hell. I mean, I would hope that, you know, you're listening to this and you're going to go off and do the wrong things, because we don't want you to succeed. Advertising, good marketing, starts with ethical products sold in ethical ways, using all the tactics that we know work to get attention, to get the story across, to move people off of the natural inaction that is their default position. Most people will not buy. They will say, we call it getting up on the fence. They will say, well, that sounds like a pretty good product, and I know I need it, and probably someday down the line, you know,
right,
I may think about buying this. You got to knock them off of that. That's the job of an advertiser, to wake them up, realize that, you know what, you may never see this thing again. If you click off of this site right now, you may never come back, or you may never find me again. So you really need to do this now. And here's why it's not no skin off your nose. There's a total guarantee. You know, it's all the risk is on me and not you. It's just get this in your hands, decide, and then if you don't want it, you can get your money back, or you blah, blah. That's why all of that stuff is in there, to help the person say, the most logical, rational choice that I can make right now is to get this and start to see what new adventure can happen in my life now that I've solved this problem, or now that I've got this information, or now that I have this product in my possession.
Gotcha.
Okay, I think, to sum up, and let me...
Okay.
Let me help you out here a bit, Kevin. Is, you know, we've got this seminar coming up, the action seminar. I think what we tried to do in this call is just give people a small taste of the difference between action-oriented advice or the hot seat model of actually interacting with people and taking questions directly, and what most seminars are like. Most seminars out there, you get talked at. You sit in the audience, and a parade of people go across the stage, and they talk at you, and you take a ton of notes, and you get home, and you don't have a clue what to do next. You're no closer to having an answer than you were before you went to the event. Even if you have new information, you have new tactics, you got met some new people, you don't know what to do next. So we decided to turn that model on its head. And as far as I know, we're the only ones doing this. We did it once last year, and we're doing one more coming up here at the end of February, and it's all based on the idea that we're going to help people get networking done so they actually meet like-minded people. And if you don't have a network, this is where you can start one. It can include experts. It can include other people in the same position you're in, whether you're a rookie or an experienced marketer or somebody who just wants to find some other people who think like you do. You're going to get to hear experts say, talk about the actionable things that you can do, and actually give you a little checklist. Do this, then do this, then do this. This whole event is based on what to do next. To figure out your goals. Excuse me. I have to take a sip of water. this is all about trying to figure out what you're going to do next, but not just figure it out, but have a concrete idea of what you could do next, and then give you all these options of what you can do next. And when we say next, we're talking about even before you get home. At the last event, people were going home after the first day, not going home, going back to their hotel rooms and actually putting things into action. This was all about implementation. This is about getting off your ass and finally moving on those dreams you have of success and wealth and fame and everything else that you're maybe stuck with right now. So get all the sticking points solved, all the questions solved. We're going to do hot seats. We're going to have some of the top copywriters in the world there who are going to take examples of copy from attendees. And this is all about, you know, this is all coming from the attendees. And tear it apart and tell them how to make it better, tell them what's working, what's not working. Actually, you'll give critiques, reviews, deconstructions, let people see behind the scenes on how copywriters actually take bad copy and turn it into good copy. We're going to take hot seats, going to actually punk people out of the audience and bring them up and show them how we solve problems personally, how we how we deal with things that have often stopped people for a long time. And we're going to show people what the experts are doing, what the cutting-edge guys, cutting-edge marketers are doing right now to bring home the bacon, to make this stuff work. Things are happening very fast online and offline.
Yeah.
We do have some offline stuff there. So if you're totally online, you should be looking at offline. If you're totally offline, you need to be online. If you're both doing online and offline, you may be overlooking some really simple ways to just jack up the results to astonishing levels. And that's what this is all about. It's like a workshop more than it is a seminar. As you come in, you're going to meet people. It's very comfortable. I don't care how shy you are. We're going to make it easy for you to meet other people and get the most out of this. So you're not going to come home with just a lot of notes. You're going to come home with an action plan. You're going to have things, I can do this, and then I can do this, and I can do this to reach this goal, and this goal. Do it very, very quickly. It's all centered on action, on implementation, on not just loading you up with a lot of information and sending you off with a good luck and a pat on the butt. This is about actually getting done. Now, Kevin, you were there last year. You saw it happen in action, didn't you?
It was absolutely fantastic. I couldn't believe the caliber of people you had there. Even the audience members, everybody, it was just the right energy going on in that room and all kinds of knowledge going around that, you know, was very impressive. It was one of the best seminars I've ever been to.
And we answered every single question from the audience. People have questioned me on this, but we did a survey right before the event, and we kept doing surveys during the event, and we answered every single question. Either I answered it, or I brought up other experts to answer it, or we went through the room to find out who had the best answers for this, but nobody left there with an unanswered question. That was a big part of this. So, plus, getting out of Dodge, actually going somewhere. I know a lot of people are saying, I don't go to seminars. I don't want to go to a seminar. Please don't make me, you know, please don't even ask me to go to a seminar. I will tell you that all the top marketers go to events. Sometimes several events in a year, sometimes several events in a month. But they do it because of the networking, because of it's different when you get out of your regular workaday world. You get away from your office, get away from your family, get away from your town, go somewhere. And we're having this in San Diego, so it's a really nice place to be this time of year anyway. And just hang out with like-minded people. Everyone there is in the same mindset you're in. They like business. They like marketing. They want to do better. They're looking for answers. They're looking to meet some new people. They're looking to expand their network to find some information that they can implement right away. It's all there. It's like Disneyland for marketers.
It really is. It really is. I couldn't go on and on enough about that seminar.
You and Bond are going to be there. I imagine you're going to be willing to meet and hang out with any of the people that come from your list. You'd love to meet them. And, So why don't you give them? They have you have a site to send them to, right?
Yeah, they can go and sign up for your event through our link. It'll be www.thegaryhalbertletter.com/action.htm. And that's where you can sign up and join us all and meet us and have a great time and learn a lot. I learned a lot. I was still learning a lot from that seminar. I was impressed.
Why don't you give that link again?
www.thegaryhalbertletter.com/action.htm.
So thegaryhalbertletter.com /action.htm.
Yeah, the has to be in there, yeah.
And it's HTM.
.htm.
Okay, very good. Okay, that was great. That's
thanks.
We went just a little bit over the time I had put, but it was great. I always love talking with you, Kevin.
You too.
I've known you since you were a teenager.
Yeah.
And watched you and Bond grow up, and, you know, it's really fun. We're in a fun period of time. What's that Chinese curse? May you live in interesting times. These are certainly interesting times. And it's even more interesting for marketers. So the more you are, you know, for anyone listening here, the more you're able to actually hang out with people like Kevin and Bond, meet me and the people that I hang out with, the more you're actually you're able to do that, the more fun you're going to have, the more action you're actually going to have in your life, and the more results you're going to get, the more tied into this world where things are happening fast. You need resources. You need people you can talk to, places you can go where you trust them, where they trust you, where there's actually a relationship, and it's not just a predatory, mercenary, you know, capitalistic relationship. There's all kinds of things going on. Kevin and Bond are two of the most generous guys I know. They have a lot of info and a lot of love to give out there for marketers. So I hope people take Kevin up on this and get this, and I'll see you guys in San Diego.
All right. Thanks, John, for taking the time out to do this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye, pal.